Welcome to Chasing That Neon Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Pope. Join me on each episode as I interview session players, songwriters, sidemen, and women, people with great stories about the music and musicians that so many of us still love. All right, let's get to it. Today you're going to hear episode one of Chasing That Neon Podcast, which happens to be my very first podcast interview. You might be able to tell, but my guest, he's a true professional, and it was his storytelling and kindness that carried the show. His name is Dick McVey. When I got the idea to do these podcast interviews, I was kind of nervous to announce it. I mean, I wasn't sure if anybody would want to come on the show yet, but there are so many people in the music business that I look up to and admire. I want to hear their stories, and I want to share them. Well, Dick McVey is one of them, and I'm so honored he took the time to let me come over, set up my little old mic, and fire away. His resume speaks for itself. His accomplishments are the result of a relentless approach to working hard, sowing seeds, and reaping that harvest. He's a dreamer, but most importantly, he's a doer. That's what I love about Dick McVey. Since we recorded this interview, his book came out and it's available on Amazon right now. The book is called Appalachian Dreamer, From a Coal Camp in West Virginia to the Stage of the Grand Ole Opry. How about that? And that book went to number one in the music business category. Number one. I just ordered my copy, and I cannot wait to jump into it. It literally just got here. I hope you'll feel the same way after hearing this show. So let's get to it right now. Welcome, Mr. Dick McVey. All right, I'm here so excited to be in Hendersonville, Tennessee today with Mr. Dick McVey. He's got a comment, a quote on his website. If it's about music, I probably do it. And I can't think of anything more true about to describe you and your biography and what you do every day. I was looking here, and man, you've been on the Grand Ole Opry more than 500 times.
Yeah.
Not just as a musician, Independent Producer of the Year award. You've won that. You've won awards for Publicity Company of the Year, Who's Who in America. You've been an agent and manager. You are an agent and manager for some of America's top tribute artists. Senior editor and Nashville bureau chief for Performance Magazine. State of West Virginia, your home state?
Yeah.
State of West Virginia, they named you the ambassador of music. It's an incredible honor.
Mm-hmm.
Nominee of the West Virginia Music Hall of Fame. Top 10 nominee for Musician of the Year. Now, y'all keep hang on and just listen to this. Gold Record Award for Publicity from George Jones. I love that, the possum. Played bass guitar for more than 20 major artists. You've produced and recorded more than 500 albums. And I'm also going to ask you about, are you the only guy that has spun your guitar around multiple times on the Grand Ole Opry?
As far as I know, I'm the only one that didn't get fired doing it.
Anyway. Yeah. Tell that story real quick. So you've been playing on the Opry.
Right. And I was watching ZZ Top, and they came out with the song Legs. I think it was 1982. And they actually spun the guitars around in the video. And I thought, man, that's really cool. And I started researching, and I found a company that made what they call spin straps. So I bought one, and they had a plate that would attach to the back of the guitar I had at the time. I just strapped that on there, and I could spin the guitar 360 degrees, sometimes two, three times.
Wow.
So I'm backstage at the Opry, and of course the guys were all infatuated with the fact that I could spin this guitar, so they're all saying, hey man, see, so I'm spinning it, showing off, and I'm on the side of the stage. We're going to go on stage probably in the next 5 minutes, but I'm spinning, and I would normally spin it clockwise, but for some reason they said, how many spins can you get? And I said, well, I usually get three before it loses momentum. But I said, we could try for four, and I'll spin it this way where I can get the leverage under the
right
and go counterclockwise. And when I spun it, it spun right off into the floor because you weren't supposed to spin it counterclockwise. And it fell just, you know, that feeling you get in your gut when the guitar hits the floor like that. So I grabbed it up, and there was a tuner on stage. Well, I got it screwed back on, and I ran over to the tuner and tuned up and did the show. But
you've done it on stage during the show.
Yes.
Yeah.
I would usually wait till the song was over, and then I would do a couple of spins, and the audience, they got a kick out of that. And
yeah.
Of course, some of the artists, I'm sure, wouldn't have appreciated that, but...
Do you remember who
I believe,
what songs you did it at the end of?
I believe it was Stonewall Jackson.
Oh, yeah.
I believe it was...
yeah.
But I'm not sure. I can't remember exactly. But I would always wait till the end of the song, make sure everything went... I didn't want it falling off on the floor in the middle
of the song. Right, in the middle of the song.
So, yeah.
That's
but
great.
I would usually do two spins on stage.
Yeah.
And
well, I've never seen anybody do it on the Opry, and you know, I think you've got a pretty safe claim there.
I don't think anybody's ever done that.
Yeah,
I don't think they have.
You brought some rock and roll to the stage. I like that.
Well,
man.
Yeah, it was a little bit over the top for the Opry, but
yeah,
I'm sure I got some criticism.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. Well, was Roy Acuff around when you tried to pull this off?
I'm not sure he was. I probably wouldn't have done it if he was around.
In the wings.
Yeah.
I don't blame you there.
Or Hal Durham, who was the manager of the Opry at the time.
Yeah.
You wouldn't want to see him over on the side of the stage with a scowl
right.
on his face.
I can only imagine, man.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool. I saw that. You have a really interesting Facebook page where every post I see, and really for years I've been seeing these informational, positive, cool stories, and also, you know, hey artists, young artists move into town like myself, I came here, I don't know anything, I can read Dick McVey's posts and I can learn a whole lot about how to go about my business if I want to be in the music business.
Well, the main thing I do with those posts is try to keep people out of trouble.
Yeah.
Try to encourage people who are maybe thinking about giving up, or this is a tough business, and they need that positive reinforcement every now and then from time to time. And we've all been through it. It's not like it's anything new or anything that's, you know, it's gone on forever and ever. There's been a lot of, you know, it's a tough business, and people get bummed out over it sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you're always very encouraging and also constructive. You point out things that, hey, you know, if you're doing this, these results won't be as good, you know, but if you try this, you're going to get better results. And I really appreciate all those you've posted, you continue to post over the years. And then you sprinkle in those stories like that spinning guitar. I had to talk to you about that.
Yeah.
I think that's cool.
Well, I'm writing a book now about my life. And then when I get finished with that one, I'm going to kind of do a how-to.
Oh, yeah.
To let people know.
Right.
And I'm going to take it from when you're in the bedroom first learning all the way up to, you know, trying to be a professional musician and beyond.
That I can't wait till this book is out. I've heard you talk about that, and I think that's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you about, because I know you're a walking, talking book of history, great experiences, and information. And we haven't even talked about it. We hadn't even got into some of the people, you know, we mentioned Stonewall, but you've played with a lot of people over the years. And I counted, I was going through the list, I counted, and correct me if I'm wrong, I got 10 members of the Country Music Hall of Fame, and then 2 members of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as well, musicians that you've been on stage with, country acts that just grabbed my attention, Trace Atkins, Bobby Bear, Little Jimmy Dickens, Dave Dudley, 6 Days on the Road, I love that song.
Sure.
And then you got one that really stopped me, and I just took a breath when I read it, Holly Dunn. You know, the late Holly Dunn, unfortunately. We lost her about 4 years ago, I believe.
Right.
And Daddy's Hands, one of my favorite songs ever. And even Holly had she actually had talked about you playing in her touring band and playing and on and mixing her last CD.
Right.
I just thought that was fabulous. I'm a big fan of hers.
Yeah, We were really close, you know. She, I don't know why. We just had a rapport with each other that was, it was kind of, I can't describe it.
Yeah.
I'm at a loss for words. But, you know, we continued to communicate once she left town and went back out to the Southwest. And, but she was great to work with.
I mean,
she was one of the guys she would, you know, whatever. She was a member of the band, really. She didn't look at herself as a star, and she treated us all, you know, she wouldn't do anything just because it was her. She would do things that were all inclusive of the band. So
right. When you have been on stage with folks like Holly or, you know, any of these folks I've been talking about, I mean, there's a huge list. And they play that song, their big song, like Daddy's Hands.
Yeah.
When you're sitting there playing that with them and you're watching the crowd, what's that like, you know, when you see them all singing that back to her and you're part of that?
It's surreal. It's, you know, I go back to when I was a kid, you know, and I started dreaming about walking on a big stage and that. And it's just, you're living that dream.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
I would have to say to myself, that's little Jimmy Dickens there. Because it was so unbelievable.
Yeah.
And I don't know how else to describe it. It's you're scared to death because this is their signature song. Don't mess it up.
Mm-hmm.
You've got that going on in your mind.
Yeah.
And then you're trying to enjoy the moment as well. You know, you're looking out and you're seeing hundreds of people, or sometimes thousands, depending on who the artist was. But it's just so unbelievable to me that I'm standing here playing Honky Tonk Angel with Kitty Wells.
My gosh,
it's just unbelievable that I had the opportunity to do that. You know,
yeah, I was looking here. You know, we talked about all these cool things you've been a part of and accomplished. It's an amazing list. And one of the things that I thought of when I read through it all, I thought, who was Dick McVeigh before this list? Before you did these things, what is it about you? What was it in you that took you from a guy who hadn't done all those things to a guy who has and continues to do them? Where did it all start for you?
Well, musically speaking, I've always had a weekend band since the time I was 15. You know, weekend warriors, and I had day jobs. You know, I worked at a coal mine. I'm a licensed funeral director and embalmer.
Really?
And
wow.
But even during the, you know, all those times when I was working days, I would have my weekend band. And I wanted to play so bad that I learned a lot of skills that I didn't really realize I was learning. But as time passed, I was the booking agent for the band. I was the manager for the band. I was the publicity person. And
yeah,
I learned all those skills at 15, 16, 17 years old because I wanted to play so bad that I jumped in and handled the business. And what I found over the years is generally creative people, like artists, painters, musicians, songwriters, they think with a different mindset than a business person does.
Right.
And you find that the artists that are most successful in this business are those people who can combine the creative with the business.
Yeah.
And those two things, if you can cross over, you know, then you'll probably have a successful career. But people like Garth and Reba are both very good business people.
Yeah.
And while they're great people to fraternize with and be around, and they just do everything for their fans and this and that, don't get in their way from a business standpoint because they'll try and steamroll you.
Yeah.
And that's just the way, that's the business, that's the way it is. But having that knowledge of business is very important.
Very competitive industry, and not, you know, there's only so much airtime on that radio.
Sure. My thing was, everything that's successful in life has three elements. It has a goal, it has a plan, and it has a team. So those three things, if you've got all of that in order and you've got people who have good business sense, then what I did is, back when I was doing weekends, I said, okay, I want to play here in Beckley, West Virginia, which was near my hometown.
Right.
I did that. Okay, I want to play in Charleston, West Virginia, which is 50 miles down the road. I did that. Okay, I want to play in Virginia. I want to play in Kentucky. I did that. And it just kept going on and on and on. And finally it got to the point where I said, you know, this band, the band that I was working with, are excellent musicians. And I said, it's time that we maybe go on the road professionally.
Yeah.
So I went, contacted an agent in Huntington, West Virginia. And he was booking those, what we call the Ramada Inn circuit, you know, hotel lounges, doing show bands kind of stuff, which is where the money was. And we set out and started doing a tour, you know.
Wow, yeah.
And so we ended up here in Nashville for 5 weeks. at the Ramada, or at
really?
The, I'm sorry, at the Holiday Inn out on Elmo Pike.
Okay.
It's not that anymore, but it was back then. And it was a nice room. The issue was we were there in the summer, and they didn't have rooms for us.
Oh,
so
no.
We had to sleep in our vans. And it was one of the hottest summers on record for Nashville.
What year is this, by the way?
79, 80. We went
and
on the road.
You're sleeping in your van in Nashville playing five or six nights, the Ramada.
Yeah, 6 nights a week.
Wow.
And, you know, I think the low temperature was like 82. So, you know, there was no relief. You'd go to the swimming pool. We were staying at the KOA campground. We'd go to the swimming pool, and it was like bathwater.
Oh, I bet. So,
it was rough.
Man, let's go back to your when you were in West Virginia.
Yeah.
What was your first instrument, and what did you have visions of, I want to play this instrument, or was it just like, I just want to be on stage? I don't care.
It was the Beatles.
Okay.
Because I was 15, and the Beatles came along, and it was just, my dreams became recurring.
Oh, yeah.
Me walking on stage like the Beatles and all this adulation from the girls, you know.
Yeah.
At 15, that's what you're thinking about. So, there was a high school band where I was going to high school, and they performed at a school assembly one time, and the girls went crazy over them. And I thought, wow, this is good. So I put a band together. I was playing. My dad had taught me guitar.
Okay.
And
cool.
So we started, we learned, you know, the stuff, mainly the British Invasion bands from back then. And it worked out pretty well for us. We were playing all the local school dances and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just kind of gradually grew from that point.
You played the Ramada Inn here in Nashville.
Holiday Inn.
Holiday, I'm sorry. Holiday Inn here in Nashville. And you're... How do you go from there to, I'm moving here?
Okay. in Beckley, West Virginia, there was a Ramada Inn there.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a lounge there called the Velvet Mine, which was kind of a playoff of the coal miners who lived in the area.
Yeah.
So the Velvet Mine brought in show bands from all over the country. So when I first started getting the inkling that this band's going to be good enough to go on the road and compete, I started going to watch all the shows,
mm-hmm.
and I would take notes. I would find out what they did that worked and what they did that didn't work.
Wow.
And I built a show around, I stole all their stuff, you know.
Wow.
I built a show around that. And then when the agent from Huntington came up to see us to see if he would be interested, we had a pretty good show together. So that's where it all started. And,
man, that's great.
And then I had met a guy who was in a show band from Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
His name was John Frost. And John, who became one of the four guys that were Opry members.
Okay.
Right? He became one of the singers in the four guys. Well, he had told me, we became friends because he was a bass player and I was a bass player. So he said, if you ever come to Nashville, give me a call and I'll show you around, that kind of thing. Well, when we got here, I didn't realize he had gone on to, you know, play on the Opry. I thought he was still playing bass in bands. And,
right.
But I called his mom. His mom answered the phone, and she said, no, John's playing on the Grand Ole Opry with the four guys. And I thought, no. And she said, oh, yeah, he's doing that. So I finally got in touch with him, and at that time they were doing matinees, like shows in the afternoon.
Okay. Yeah.
And he invited me to go backstage with him at the Opry. And, man, from there I was just hooked on it.
Yeah.
And another thing was I was 30 years old at the time, so I'm looking at – the crowd's getting, me getting older and the crowd's staying the same age, you know? And I'm thinking, how much longer can I do this rock and roll and disco and all this kind of stuff?
Right.
How long can I do this before I start really looking out of place, you know? So I decided at that point in time, I was looking at the Opry and I was looking at all these older musicians who were still very viable and, and you know, so that planted that seed that, you know, if I want to have longevity as a musician, I need to get into country music more. And I grew up in Appalachia, up in West Virginia, so country music was always a part of my life. But, of course, I strayed when the Beatles led me off of that path, you know.
Well, that's understandable.
Yeah.
Hey, it's all about the girls.
Yeah,
the girls were hollering at the Beatles.
The girls were hollering and the girls were hollering at us.
Oh, I bet.
So, man, what else do you need?
Exactly. That's what I think... I can say for sure that was a big part of why I picked up a guitar there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Same age too, 15.
Yeah.
That's really cool. So you moved here and just started working right away.
Well, I told John, I said, man, if I could just get a gig with somebody. And this is crazy because
there's
guys who've been here 15, 20 years that never get an opportunity. But I go back to West Virginia. We had a couple of weeks we did in Stillwater, Oklahoma, and then I went home to visit with my parents and my sister. And when I got up there, I get a call from John, and he says, Stonewall Jackson is looking for a bass player. And I said, okay.
Wow.
He said, can you come down and audition? And I said, sure. So I went down, passed the audition. He hired me. First gig we played was at Tootsie's. It was kind of a benefit type show. Part of that, and so we did that show, and then he said, we're going to be playing the Opry next weekend. And at the time, he had a song out called Old Chunk of Coal, which John Anderson covered and just killed his version of it, but at the time, that was going pretty strong, and so we were going to play that song on the Opry. And we did that, and I'm thinking, man, this is so great. It's so great. Somebody asked me when I came off stage, well, what'd you think? Because he knew it was my first time. What did you think? And I said, I don't remember. I need to do it again. You know, because I don't remember what just happened.
Yeah.
So, this is the following week, Stonewall had a road gig. And they said, well, you know, you drive the bus, right? And I said, well, no, I've never driven a bus. And they said, well, gee, we need somebody that can drive the bus. So, that was my welcome to Nashville. Yeah. Hired, and within 8 days, you know, I'm fired because I can't drive the bus.
Oh. No, I thought you were going to say you drove the bus.
No.
No. Well, I
didn't know how.
Yeah.
And back then, there weren't all these automatic things. There was a stick, and you had to be you had to be trained, basically, to drive that.
Wow.
So I did that. And then when I got out of that deal, I needed money, and so I picked up the phone book, and I just got in the Yellow Pages, which is Google for now. Right. And I every business that I could find that was related to music, I called them. I probably called 150 people just trying to get my foot in the door. And I didn't care what it was. You know, I felt comfortable enough that as an agent and a manager, I felt comfortable enough that I could go in and be an asset to the company. And Lewis Owens, Dolly Parton's uncle, I talked to him. He said, well, why don't you come down? Let's talk. Because he found out I was from West Virginia. Mm. Of course, he grew up in East Tennessee. So we had that Appalachian Mountain, you know. And so I went down and talked to Lewis, and I didn't know who he was. I didn't know he was Dolly's uncle.
Yeah, okay.
And so when he found out, you know, a lot of people use people to get to artists. And once he found out I didn't know who he was, it was like, oh.
Oh,
so this guy's really sincere about it. You know, wanting to work for me and not knowing. Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
So he hired me, and he had a bus. He was the guy who initiated merchandise sales on the road for artists. And so we went out and sold T-shirts for Dolly and Barbara Mandrell and Merle Haggard and all these people. And so in the process of that, I sat down and wrote letters to three people from my home area in West Virginia that were big here. Little Jimmy Dickens, Russ Hicks, the steel guitar player, and Charlie McCoy. I sat down and wrote letters. I am from West Virginia. I just got to town looking for work. Well, the thing with Little Jimmy Dickens is I had worked with his half-brother at a coal mine. And so I mentioned, hey, I know Frank and, you know. The day my letter got to his house, he had fired his bass player and drummer for smoking pot with the daughter of a sheriff who was actually promoting the show they were doing.
Are you serious?
Yeah. So my letter...
The day
my letter arrived, he fired them. And so Mona, his wife, calls me and says, would you be able to go to Little Rock, Arkansas and do a show this weekend? And I'm thinking, God, I'm not prepared for this at all because I didn't read the number system at that time. I knew some of his songs, but I didn't know enough songs to do a full show, so I knew I was going to have to bust my butt to learn all that stuff. And so they hired me, sight unseen, to come and do this show. And I'm telling you, I'm not ready for it, but I'm not going to pass up the opportunity either. So I worked as hard as I could in the few days I had. And we went out and did the show. Actually, before that, here I have another Nashville moment, because the next day after they tell me they're going to do that, Mona calls and says, oh, you know, I didn't know it, but Jim had talked to another bass player, and I think he's going to be able to do this thing. So I'm thinking, oh, here we go again, you know.
Yeah.
But she called me back and said, he can't do it. You're in.
Nice.
So.
And there you
were. We listened to an 8-track of Jim's songs on the way to the show, and the funny thing was, I had learned them pretty much like the record, but somebody in the band or he would say, well, that's not exactly how we do it.
Oh, really?
And I'd say, well, and the band kept encouraging, oh, you'll be fine. Don't worry about it. And we did that first show, and I knew I was going to get fired, because I don't know how many mistakes I made. I was nervous. I was scared. I came out of a bar band, and now I'm playing in front of 3,000 people in Little Rock, and I'm thinking, there's no way he's going to keep me. But he did. So.
Wow. But your adaptability is amazing, you know. And you even, so you have the job with the T-shirt.
Yeah.
But you're like, no, okay, I'm going to do this too. I'm going to send these letters out.
Yeah.
You don't just get somewhere and go, okay, I'm just going to sit here. Always forward thinking.
It's never going to come to you.
That's
it. It's never going to come to you.
Yeah, that's it.
You're going to have to go after it.
Yeah.
I've, over the years, one of the common themes when people come here to talk about recording and being a star, and it's like, well, I look good and I sound good. Can't you get me a record deal? You know, and it's a little bit more to it than that.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I'm amazed that survivability is the key thing in any industry. You know, adapting, surviving, and you're amazing at that. Just
well, another thing that happened with the Dickens and T-shirt connection was Merle Haggard asked Dickens to open his shows, and so Lewis was selling T-shirts for Merle Haggard. So I would go up. I was the guinea pig. I'd do the first song. Then Dickens would come on and do his show. And then I'd go out to the merch table and sell T-shirts. I was making more money selling T-shirts than I was playing.
Really?
But for a while, man, I was double dipping.
I was about to say double
dipping. Yeah, it was great.
You're doing the first song? You're going out?
I did the first song.
Really?
I was the guinea pig for the sound man.
Oh, my
God. Although they do a sound check.
Yeah.
But, you know, they always want to make sure when it's showtime that if there's any issue, it's going to be me and not the next guy. So.
Yeah. That's funny.
Yeah.
Double dipping, man. Two Rock and Roll Hall of Famers here. Terry Sylvester with the Hollies.
Mm-hmm.
Long Cool Woman.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, you know, it's got that little bass intro on Long Cool Woman.
Yeah.
Do, 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 do.
Yeah.
And again, it's surreal. Here's somebody that I grew up listening to all my life who's a hero.
Right.
And that song is a classic that, you know, you've played it, and it's like, here I am playing it with the guy from the Hollies. So, and that bass line came around as doo 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 doo.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing.
And yeah.
I love that you're amazed in all these moments, too.
It's not
You're not just up there going, okay, well, here's the chart. Whatever.
No, no, it was real.
So, DJ Fontana is also on this list. And if you're listening, you don't know who DJ Fontana is. He played drums for Elvis in the year, in the mid-50s. He got in Elvis's band. How'd you meet DJ?
Actually, I met DJ. I was playing. A girl hired me to do a show in Louisiana with her, and she had a bus, and DJ was her drummer at the time.
Oh,
so
wow.
We rode the bus together and became friends. I mean, we were...
Yeah.
After that, we were always...
He's another one we lost.
Yep.
But, yeah, DJ, he had a lot of great stories that I heard on you know, different shows and stuff. I've always been into this kind of stuff.
Yeah, so. He told me, I asked him one time, I said, tell me a story that you haven't told anybody else about Elvis. And he said, Elvis's feet would stink. And he said it got so bad, this one pair of shoes got so bad that we threw them out the window one night, you know. And so I thought there's a story nobody's ever going to hear.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I've never heard it, that's for sure. You've opened shows for Chuck Berry, David Allen Coe, Crystal Gayle, We talked about Merle.
Yeah.
We just talked about that. B.B. King.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yep.
B.B. King. Jerry Lee Lewis. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
So we spent a summer with him when he showed up.
When he showed up, yeah.
I got some great stories that'll be in the book about our summer with Jerry Lee. It was interesting.
What's the name of the book?
I haven't even got a title.
Okay, all right.
I was talking the other night with my wife. We were trying to come up with something, but it's going to have to be something really good.
You know? I was trying to break news here. That's what I was trying to do. But Ricky Nelson and Tammy Wynette. I love this. Loretta Lynn. Yeah. And Mary Wilson of the Supremes. How did y'all cross paths?
Actually, in China.
In China.
Yeah, wow. we went to China with Travis, our Elvis tribute artist.
Yeah.
We went to China, and they had hired Dan Seals and Mary Wilson and Jerry and the Pacemakers.
Okay, yes.
And Travis. And so we spent...
What a package.
We spent three or four. We did... Actually, we were doing private shows. They were Christmas shows for Watson Drinking Water.
Really?
And this company, based in England, I think, but had a huge business in China. So they hired us to come over and play their Christmas party. So we went... We did the Hong Kong... We did a show, and then we went over into Shenzhen, into Communist China.
Yeah.
To do a show. That's another surreal moment for me, because I'm standing there getting ready to cross the border into Communist China, and I'm thinking, as a kid, oh, God, you wouldn't even think about going close to the border. And here I am,
Music just takes you down these
incredible journeys. Yeah, and Jerry and the Pacemakers, good gracious. That, for me, you know, I mean, that was one of the British invasion bands that I grew up with, so... Such a pleasure to be around those guys.
So many validations in your life of, I did the right thing going down this path. You know, when you're standing there working a show with Jerry and the Pacemakers, like that was what you were envisioning that when you were a kid, and that's what you're doing, you know?
Yeah, the dream.
In Communist China, of all places.
Yeah, crazy.
So something that you developed years ago here in Nashville, it's called the Musicians Referral Service.
Mm-hmm.
What caused you to do this and why, the Musicians Referral Service?
Well, I don't want to say anything too bad about the Musicians Union, but I found out when I came to Nashville that there were so many musicians here and sidemen that they didn't really do a good service for those players. They were concentrated on the symphony players, mm-hmm. the session musicians, and the stars. Other than that, you know, if you were just a sideman out here trying to make a living doing club gigs, didn't really see anything that they were actually doing that I thought was adequate.
Right.
So Tom Holland was the drummer with Little Jimmy Dickens, and Tom was the guy when I came to town. Everybody would call Tom if they needed a musician, because he would go out to the clubs at night and gather up cards, and so he knew a lot of people. And I decided, you know, why not, instead of having somebody call, why don't I put a list of musicians that are available in the hands of the people that are doing the hiring?
Yeah.
It's a totally unique concept, because most referral services, you know, you would have to go to the referral service mm-hmm. to get the name and number, and that's how they made money. But I was charging $5 a month to have your name on my list.
Wow.
And my list would go out to all the booking agents, all the managers, all the artists, all the nightclubs, all the performing arts centers, all the theaters. I would do that every month. And it got to be, you know, there was times I had over 100 people on that list.
Golly.
And that, back then, it was $500 for a musician.
Yeah.
It was extra money, you know.
Yeah.
So,
another example of you just kind of getting the temperature of the room, the lay of the land, and going, okay, there's something that I could do here. There's something I could step up and fill a void.
You know? Well, I saw people calling Tom all the time looking for musicians. So I said, why, if we can... go ahead and put guys that are really looking for work and put their name out there. And it had their name, their phone number, whether or not they could sing, and then a brief description, 25 words, I believe it was, of how they would describe themselves.
And how much work did these guys get out of that? I mean, there's a guy here, Greg Baker. He bass player and band leader for Trace Atkins.
Right.
And he claims that he wouldn't have got that gig if it weren't for the referral service that you started.
Well,
it talks about you on there that you connected them.
I placed people with a lot of major artists.
Yeah.
Because when somebody was auditioning, rather than them putting out a cattle call where they would have people lined up around the building, mm-hmm. they would call people who were on my list and audition them first. So it became, and I sit down one day and figured up, I placed over 10,000 musicians in working jobs.
Wow. Golly.
That's, I mean, that blew my mind when I looked at the figure, because
I believe it. I mean,
it's unbelievable, but it's
with
the number of musicians there were, and of course there was a lot more work back then, so that's why I discontinued it around 2000, because it was at that point the internet was, you know, people were using the internet more, and the, you know, the Ramada Inn lounge gigs were pretty much gone. A lot of the live venues were gone. Drunk driving laws, more entertainment options to stay home. People just quit going out, and so the venues just, you know, they sort of went away.
Right. Well, that's sad.
It is.
It's changed like that. Well, speaking of that change, I watched the Ken Burns documentary, and Chet Atkins said something I found amazing, because I'm watching all these artists, you know, Loretta Lynn and all, just, I go through the whole list, but if you've seen it, you know what I'm talking about. The 50s and 60s era, I love 70s, all the way through the 90s. That's, I love so much of that music, and I'm very sentimental, nostalgic, very moved by all that. And I think, I watch those guys, I'm like, those are real artists. That's real music. And that's, I get caught up in that. Well, Chet Atkins was asked about the Nashville sound, and he pulled change out of his pocket. I'm going to pull keys out of mine, but we'll just pretend it's change. All right. And he did that with change. He said, that's the Nashville sound. Now, that's the 60s. And it stunned me. And I chuckled. I thought it was funny. But it also stunned me, because I thought, well, that's what we complain about now. I don't associate that with the 1960s music or the 50s. But how much has that been so much a part of it, and we just don't even realize it? And is it really that much different? Rocky Balboa said in a movie, he said, you know, not much has changed, just the clothes. You've been through all these different eras. What in your mind has changed the most? Or is it that different at all as far as the motivation, the way the system works?
Well, the business side hasn't changed at all. It's marketing and how you market yourself. Because the one thing about music is, you know, if you go to the grocery store and there's a Coca-Cola on the shelf and there's a Pepsi there and there's a Knee High or whatever, you got your choice of picking the one, and it's usually the one that's the most attractive or the one that has the biggest buzz going about it, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So an artist is the same way. An artist has to make himself look good, be unique, all of those factors. You know, labels back then used to take an artist that was ungroomed, and they would put them in a program called artist development, and they would bring that artist along, and then in a matter of a year or two, they'd put something out on them to see how it worked. Nowadays, if you go to a label, you better have all that already done and ready to go. That's the biggest change, I think. And then there are, maybe I shouldn't say this, but there are record deals that are being bought. People are going in. Look at a label with a new artist. It's a great expense to that a label because they have to do the video, they have to do the recording, they have to do the marketing and the publicity and hire the attorney and all this.
Right.
Lots and millions of dollars to get an act out there and get it started. So if an act came in with a financial backer, the label would look more fondly on him than they would an artist who comes in off the street and says, I've got what it takes, just need a chance. Well, can you help us pay for this? Can you help us pay for that? Do you have any backing? And so a lot of it has gone in that direction, too.
Right.
And to me, you know, independent record labels always did that. They always had the artist paid for everything, and the label would produce it, put it out, and even hire the promotion team to promote it.
Wow.
And but the artist bore all of that expense. And so at some point, the major labels picked up on this and thinking, you know, this is going to, especially when times would get lean, they would start looking at ways to cut budgets and save money. And here's an artist who's going to come in. He's going to pay for the session. He's going to pay for the video, all of this. That act was very attractive at that point. So a lot of that went on and still goes on, as far as I know.
Well, and there's so much now that you build your own fan base. You do all that.
You're
show
the artist
up with it.
Yeah, you are developing that artist that they want. They don't have to do it. They don't have to spend the money.
And they can see who's committed that way, too, you know. If somebody's spent years building their own base, doing the shows, I mean, that's worth the investment.
It is.
Yeah, and I can see that from a business sense.
The negative side of the internet is there's so much bad stuff on there.
Yeah.
So how do you drive traffic to your particular site and your type or style of music? I can give you a trick on one of the things that people are doing. They're going to these websites where there are blogs for a certain act. So if you find an act that's similar to yours, you go on that blog and there are like email addresses and you can glean those fans. Hey, if you like this guy, how about listening to mine? See what you think of that. And a lot of acts are picking up, you know,
fans and
because of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, you leave it to you to figure out these things.
You got to use the psychology of, I try to, you know, even when I was doing records back in the 80s, you know, I was producing records, you know, the color blue, I was looking at the psychology of certain colors, what appealed. So I started doing my records on blue vinyl, just based on the psychology of how the blue color appeals to, you know, certain factions.
As soon as you said that, I thought about my favorite vinyl Elvis record is Moody Blue, and it's blue. It's a blue vinyl.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so amazing.
I just try to outthink people.
Yeah.
Or think beyond.
Get up a little
and
head.
And I think we've lost a lot of that creativity. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a big P.T. Barnum fan, you know.
Yeah.
P.T. Barnum used to, you know, had the circus, and so he had elephants, which generally nobody had seen. And this is back in the days, too, before there was a lot of TV or anything going on. So people would go to the circus, and it became a three-ring circus where there's three acts going at once. Well, if he saw the crowd start to get, you know, antsy or kind of bored maybe, he would say, bring out the elephants. So anytime there was a lull in the show or he felt a lull, he would bring the elephants out and parade them around, and it would regenerate their audience. Yeah. So that's kind of how I think. I think about what would P.T. Barnum do in this case?
Yeah.
How can we do this? How can we do that? And look at it from a psychological standpoint as well as the physical. Another thing that I used to do is I'd come up with publicity stunts, and I'm not going to give you the big one that I've got because it hasn't been done yet, and I think I'm going to get it done.
Oh, yeah.
But one thing we did is I had a rock and roll singer who lived in the southeastern corner of Iowa. There's three states right there. I don't remember exactly which three. So we put together this thing. I came up with this idea. We'll do the world's fastest rock and roll tour. And so what we did is I hired a limo. We put equipment in all three of these states, and he would play one song, hop in the limo, go to the next state, do one song, hop in the limo, go to the next state. So we did the world's fastest rock and roll tour, three states in 17 and a half minutes. And we got so much publicity out of that. I mean, I had radio people and people calling from all around the world, South Africa and Europe and England, that, you know, of course we did the publicity, we put it out there. But people just loved that idea. And he actually was featured in Guitar Magazine.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So cool. Yeah. So a good businessman, Travis LeDoit.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you, kind of pick your brain on the difference between somebody who's just doing Elvis songs and somebody who's really connecting with an audience like he does.
Well, Travis is a rare artist. And we first met at a rockabilly festival in Jackson, Tennessee. I helped Henry Harrison, who had the rockabilly show there. I did it with him for 3 years. DJ and I were standing at the edge of the stage talking. And all of a sudden, DJ just started staring and his mouth came open. And he said, I want you to look at that. And I said, what? He said, look at this kid. He looks like Elvis. And so here's Travis walking across the parking lot. Well, that's the first time I'd ever met Travis as well. But later on that night, he performed. Marty Stewart was there and a bunch of people. And the DJ was playing drums, and Travis got up and did a couple of songs, and I was just blown away. And so my initial intent with him was just to make sure nobody took advantage of him. you know, if anybody offers you anything, give me a call. Let's talk. You know, don't jump right into anything. And as time passed, you know, we developed this relationship. Now, 20 years later, we're still together. We had a contract the first year. After that, we've worked together as friends. Mm-hmm. We've never had an argument. We've had some disagreements over things. Yeah. But typically, it's just been a great relationship. And Travis is Travis. The thing about Travis, though, his personality and Elvis's are just so parallel. He has the wit that Elvis had on stage. Mm-hmm. He has the charisma that's indescribable with any artist like that. And I told him from the beginning, we're always going to take care of the fans. We're always going to take care of the fans. I don't care how long the line is, you're going to stay there and sign autographs. Well, that wasn't a problem for him. He wanted to do it.
Yeah.
And so as time progressed, he'd start going into the audience and singing to people, and he just endeared himself to so many people who at the moment think this is Elvis, but then, you know, immediately after it's like, well, that's not Elvis, but what a nice guy.
Yeah.
So it's been more him than me. I mean, I think I've done some things for him that were really great and kept him out of trouble in some instances, but for the most part, it's him. He's great. Great to work with.
Yeah. Well,
and he's not Elvis when he comes off stage. Right. That's the greatest thing about him. When he comes off stage, he's Travis. And so people have gotten to know him through the years, because after every show, I don't care where it is or how many people are there, he's there to meet them, sign their CDs, sign their T-shirts, whatever they want. And we've always done that. And that's, you know, it's not something I had to say, man, you got to go do this. He's always, yeah, we're going to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, he's got the same mentality and approach that a Garth, a Reba, anybody, when it comes to the fans.
Yeah.
And I think that comes out in his music. I've seen the videos of you guys playing and really wanted to see a show. Actually, this year was wanting to, and then not to date this podcast, but we're in the middle of 2020. So. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that will be all. That's enough. I don't need to say anything more than that. All these things you've been a part of, the great music, the producing, booking, I could go down the whole list. What is it that you're the most proud of? Is there anything specific, or is it just the bulk of it all, or do you even spend much time thinking about that?
Well, there's certainly highlights. And, you know, if you split things up, like from a publicity standpoint, you know, handling George Jones, publicity for 3 years, the Bellamy Brothers. From a publicist standpoint, that's a real credit to
absolutely,
you know, to be able to have a gig like that and to do it, you know.
Yeah.
And from a production standpoint, you know, winning the Independent Producer of the Year that year and having your records do well. And, you know, I think from a producer standpoint, when I hear, I've got a friend who just wrote a song and he sent it to me this morning. And as soon as I hear, it's just him and an acoustic playing it. But I hear the production in my head.
Mm-hmm.
I hear it, and it's almost immediately as the song's going on, I can hear the instrumentation that's going to work. So, you know, that award was great. The West Virginia Ambassador to Music, and then last year being nominated for the West Virginia Music Hall of Fame. What a great honor that is to have.
Absolutely.
And my appearances on the Opry, that's probably the greatest achievement a country musician can have, is to walk on that stage. And I walked on it hundreds of times. So it's just a combination of all those things. Working with Merle Haggard, and I found out that Merle would go down and have breakfast early in the morning. And so I would get up and go down, and it was me and Merle sitting across the table.
Oh, my gosh.
And I could pick his brain about the business. That's one thing I did when I was with artists. Like with Tom T. Hall, a lot of the guys would want to talk hunting and fishing. But if I got him one-on-one with me, I asked him about the business, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, how do you write a hit song? He says, you got to write a movie in 3 minutes.
Wow.
How simple is that?
That's perfect.
Yeah.
Man, so many rich experiences.
Yeah, and that's learned. I wanted to learn. And then when I became the editor here in Nashville for Performance Magazine, Performance is a worldwide magazine, or it was at the time, and I was able to, you know, interview Van Halen and all these guys and be around them for a day. And it opened up so many doors that I was able to ask them the things that I wanted to know for my artists, the people that I was working with. I was trying to get as much of knowledge as I could so that I could help them.
Right. Well, you define the word hustler. I love it.
Yeah.
And
I've been lucky. Yeah. I've been very lucky.
Well,
I've been in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, I guess I can see that, but man, you're such a hustler and a thinker. And the other thing is you're by all accounts, and you know my experience as well, you're a generous, kind man. And I think that I don't know how much that has to do with it, but I feel like that has a lot to do with it.
Well, that's my dad. Yeah.
Really?
That's the raising I got in West Virginia.
What did he do?
He was a coal miner. He was actually an engineer who would go in and survey the mine so they could have up-to-date maps of that kind of thing. So he was, but, you know, he was well-liked. I can't tell you how many times when I was a kid, you know, that we'd be out and somebody'd say, man, your dad's a good guy, you know.
Wow.
You know, and I wanted to be that
same
person.
Well, that's the Dick McVeigh I know.
Yeah.
Hey, thank you for doing this.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it, man.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Appreciate it.